I'm David Laspina.
I'm Dave Bush.
And you're listening to 90.7 WGXC ACRA. And today's show is about architectural photography. We're going to talk about Ezra Stoller with our special guest, Peter Aaron. We'll be right back in a couple seconds.
Blind Spot Radio.
I have a strong feeling for architecture, much stronger than for photography. And I was interested in showing the architecture. I wasn't interested in making pretty photographs. And time and again, I would discard that pretty photograph in favor of one that was more descriptive of the architecture. And it was generally a more successful photograph anyhow. The work is there, and you photograph it. My feeling had nothing to do with it. I mean, my feeling was strictly, how do you reported honestly what he was trying to do.
You just heard Ezra Stoller talking about architectural photography. This show is about architectural photography. It's a subgenre of photography, but it has very particular form, very particular aesthetic. Today we're going to talk with Peter Aaron, local Hudson Valley resident, and he works at ESTO, which is the architectural photo agency that Ezra Stoller started with his daughter in the mid-70s. So, Dave, can you tell us a little bit about the history of architectural photography?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert, but, you know, I have done some reading, and the thing that really strikes me about architectural photography and its relationship to architecture is that it seems to be somewhat symbiotic. So, as architecture has sort of evolved, especially over the last century and a half, so has the photography of it. I think, you know, photography kind of started out as a very exciting way to record facts. And it could be argued that one of the earliest photographs recorded by Niestafor Niepce was an architectural photograph.
It was a picture of an alleyway out of his window.
And so, you know, I mean, obviously, I don't... You know, that could just be an argument could be made that that was one of the first architectural photographs because it's recording something that previously nobody knew what that thing looked like unless they actually went to that place. And I think that that's something that architectural photography does. It occupies this space in our kind of collective consciousness where the first encounter that, you know, you have with a building or a place is usually through a photograph of it.
Right, and this is a lot different from the way that things were relayed in the past, that there's obviously 3-10 centuries of human architectural history, and up until the printing press, you know, things were just propagated through appropriation. And then with the invention of the printing press, as we'll hear Ezra talk about shortly, there was only literary descriptions of buildings. So Dave's going to play that clip right now.
It used to be that young men, British especially, well-to-do, would make the grand tour and visit all of the sites, all of the ancient sites, and come back and imitate them in a way or be influenced by them. And that went on for, you know, for centuries because things didn't move that fast. And then with the invention of the printing press, you had people who were trying to describe it, a graphic experience, in words, which just most of the time doesn't work. There are a few good critics, but you can count them on the fingers of three fingers, I think.
So there he is. He's talking about how, you know, up to the printing press, the printing press being invented meant that there was a sort of relaying of stories. There was also drawings and engravings that came apart with that, and that's how people learned about architecture. You know, travel was difficult. The French in around 1851, about the first decade after photography, there's a society called the Ethnological Society of Paris, and they commissioned photographers to travel to all the great relics, to Egypt, to the Colosseum in Rome and Greece, and to the New World to photograph architecture. The thing about the first decade after the invention of photography is that Henry Fox Talbot figured out how to make, you know, multiple prints.
Right.
Up to that point, you're restricted to having a single one-of-a-kind copy of a photo, a daguerreotype.
Right.
And these images of architecture were able to be sold by photographers for a profit and to describe the great wonders of the world to a large large public. And I would say that these are the first widely distributed architectural images, and they helped form a, you know, Western human conscience of what these places looked like.
Right. I mean, I believe, I don't remember who exactly said this, but they said, you know, I can now sit in the comfort of my living room and travel to the farthest reaches of the world. And that was a sort of reference to the recorded fact of photography. So it wasn't just architecture that was being recorded. I mean, for the heliographic missions, that's true. And it was a way of preserving French culture and French architecture.
Human culture.
Right.
The French were really into the Egyptians.
Right.
So I hear. They swiped the obelisk here and there.
Right.
So the thing about the technical limits of architectural photography up to this point is lenses on cameras were very, in photography you refer to it as a standard lens.
And they weren't all that sharp either.
Yeah, these photographers were traveling with large view cameras. Things were static. They had to photograph at a certain distance. So I would say up to the mid-20th century, which coincided with the, you know, the high modern movement of architecture, buildings were photographed very matter-of-fact. That, you know, they were photographed from the facade.
Right.
Or another thing that you could...
In full sun.
In full sun. Yeah. Another thing you could do with large view cameras is they had convertible lenses, lenses that were longer, so you'd see a lot of details of architecture, of engravings, of sculpture.
Right.
You know, the interesting thing of modern view camera lenses, which had a wider scope of vision,
right,
and this new sort of architecture, which built out of the Bauhaus, had swooping elements, these strong lines. Architecture no longer had the Greek or the Roman references. You know, high modern architecture looked like a rendering, looked like a drawing. And so that lent itself very well to wide views within these buildings, dynamically describing the space.
Right.
And Ezra Stoller, a student of the Beaux-Arts movement, trained as an architect, came into photography right at the peak of the high modern era. And he was there with his camera.
So, you know, I think it's important to understand that he approached it differently, too. Meaning, you know, most photographers certainly consider the time of day and, you know, where they're going to be standing. But he also approached it by scouting the location first, figuring out where the sun was going to be at a certain time. And Peter Aaron will get into this more in the interview, but I just wanted to mention that. So, David, can you tell us a bit more about Ezra and the work that he did and the archive and all that?
Right. So I do work at Ezra Stoller's architectural photo agency, ESTO.
Right.
And the main thing is over the past 5 to 7 years, we've been digitizing his entire collection. He was incredibly prolific. He photographed over 3,000 distinct projects and buildings, which amounted to 50,000 final pieces of film. Photographed over 4 decades, between 1939, when he was at NYU training as an architect, and 79, where Peter Aaron will talk about when he started assisting. More formally, Ezra's bio is that he's known as the preeminent architectural photographer. His work defines mid-century modernism. His body of work includes iconic images of major buildings such as Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright, the Guggenheim Museum, and the Seagram Building by Mies van der Rohe. In addition, he's very well known for his pictures of the TWA terminal at JFK, designed by Ira Saarinen. There's a forthcoming monograph, which will be released later this year by Yale University Press. In the early 70s, along with his daughter, Erica Stoller, he started the architectural photo agency ESTO, which is now based in Mamaroneck, New York. His legacy continues with working architectural photographers, one of which his former assistant, Peter Aaron, worked for the agency. They're represented by the agency, and they continue working in this dynamic subgenre of architectural photography. Right. Recently, Stoller had an exhibition at Yossi Milo Gallery in Chelsea. And if you want to see more of this work, there's a searchable database of his images at EzraStoller.com, EzraStoller.com.
Peter Aaron's experience as Ezra Stoller's assistant was transformational. After 2 years of apprenticeship, he adapted his mentor's techniques and began integrating dramatic camera angles with theatrical, and I should say here, sort of cinematic lighting. Architectural photography has been his specialty for over 35 years.
So let's get started. I spoke with Peter in my backyard.
Right.
So here's the first part of the interview. Would you mind telling us a little bit how you got started in architectural photography, and how did that lead you to meeting Ezra Stoller?
I sat in on a class of his at, Parsons, and he offered to take me in as an assistant, and then that one thing led to another, and after that I was pretty much branded because I'd learned so much proprietary information about how to do good architecture and interiors photography. That now I felt like I was on my way. Ezra had a house in Rye and a business in Westchester where he filed his negatives, but everything that we did together was on the road. And so we immediately started shooting jobs together, both in the New York area and all around the country. Right. For me, it was very glamorous and exciting. This was around 1973, 74, and 75, something like that.
So what was a typical Ezra shoot like? What was the preparation? What was the execution? Was it frantic? Was it complicated? Was it simple?
Ezra was very calm about the jobs. He'd been doing it for so many decades that he didn't seem to exhibit much concern before a shoot. Typically, the architect would have sent some plans with marks on it to indicate the architect's preference of what should be shot. And then we would show up at the project, and Ezra would walk through the building and start to make notes. And he'd grumble and wouldn't share too much information, but he would be thinking about the time of day and which shots are the most important shots, and figure out how to pare this down to, say, the 20 most important views that would describe this building. And then we would spend the next day or two executing those views.
Did he make annotated notes? Or?
Yeah, that's what he'd do. He would annotate a plan, and then he would put such notes as should be shot at twilight or looks best at 9 a.m. What else might it say? Be sure that the building manager has repaired the lights in the lobby. Let's see, put up no parking signs in front of the building. There are a lot of logistical things, you know. Taking these pictures, it's one thing to be an amateur and just show up and take a picture, but to be the professional, you have to make sure everything's right. You have to at the right time, and everything has to be just so. All of the shades have to be up, the lights have to be on, the cars shouldn't be parked blocking the front of the building. There's endless things to consider. Some architects are good at anticipating this, and others, it's as though they never gave it a moment's thought. And it's a lot of trouble.
So who were some of Ezra's clients at the time?
I remember one of his biggest clients at the time I was working was the Chicago office of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, Bruce Graham. He had projects all over pretty much the Midwest, I'd say, was the most places. And we would travel around, and I remember riding in a limousine with Ezra and Bruce Graham, and he would point out each of the buildings in Chicago that they had put up, and for me it was a glamorous moment, because this is a man who seems like during his tenure had built the modern Chicago that was apparent to all of us.
prior to this, did you have much of a education in architecture, or was this sort of, you know, learning on the fly?
Yeah, I never studied architecture. Anything I learned about it, I learned from Ezra or from the architects I worked for. So they used all kinds of secret terms that were mystery to me. I never knew what a soffit was. I didn't know what fascia meant. Everything has a name, and not to mention a history and a tradition that they all know, and you feel a little bit inadequate, but as time passes, you can read about these things and you can just absorb it.
What did you learn from Ezra about the translation of a building space to the two-dimensional photograph?
Oh, there's a lot to say on this subject. Not only is it a camera angle thing that causes you to understand a space best, but it's also a time of day and lighting consideration. So first of all, I'll say that I would say there are two kinds of shots. There's what one would call an elevation or four-square parallel shot to the building, where everything is at an equal distance from the camera, and all the lines are either horizontal or vertical. And the building looks like it would in a what's called an elevation drawing. And then there's the other type of shot, which is an oblique shot, which is at either 30 or 45 degrees, there's a corner that's approaching the camera. And one always thinks in those terms when shooting architecture, should it be seen as an elevation or an oblique perspective picture? And the other thing about choosing your angle is a lot of people think that you should shoot when the sun is directly on the side of the building you're shooting, including architects. They often say now's a great time, and you look and you see the sun is exactly behind you, and then you come to realize that there's no shadows. And that's very bad. It means that you've erased some of the evidence of a three-dimensional structure, because both the left side and the right side are in full sun, and there's no modulation. So the rule that Ezra kind of taught me was shoot with either the sun off to the side or even coming from the rear, so that the shadows create the understanding of the third dimension.
But he also seemed to have lots of elements, like either a tree or a branch or something sort of, you know, closing in the space, closing in the sky. And, you know, some of that object placement is like a matter of inches or feet, like depending on how the picture's going to render, depending on where you're standing. Did he, as he was going through the area, did he just sort of carry his camera around, or did you think when he was doing the scouting process, did he make notes about where he should be standing? Or?
Oh, luckily for me, he tended to make notes because the camera was very heavy. It was a 4x5 metal camera called a Sinar P, and to carry it around too much would be exhausting. But yeah, he would consider all of those things about looking through a space to another space, looking from under a tree at a building. And it should be a dark lead-in. It shouldn't be light. It should be dark tree branch or shadowy leaves looking at a bright building. That pulls you through the third dimension. When he couldn't find such a situation, there were times when we would cut a branch and then bring it to the camera, and then I would hold it and as still as I could, and he would shoot it as a false lead-in.
Oh, wow. So what are some other interesting technical tricks and feats that you learned? Like, for example, how did he light interiors to look so natural at a time when film was slow and he was using a large format camera that presumably needed very long exposures? Did he do any supplemental lighting?
Ezra did a lot of supplemental lighting, but it was crude compared to what's done today. He did it very well. It involved flash bulbs instead of strobe, which meant that each time you fired the shutter, the bulbs would expose, and then you'd have to change them all because they weren't rechargeable or renewable. So he carried a giant box, or I carried a giant box of flash bulbs. Each bulb was about the size of maybe a 150-watt bulb, and maybe there'd be 100 of them in a case. And we would set up cheap aluminum reflectors on cheap stands, and he would focus the light just so, and put up pieces of black paper with clothespins around the edge of the reflector to shade the light off of certain objects, and wire it up to a 300-volt battery, and then to the shutter. And every time the shutter clicked, all of these bulbs, there'd be maybe as many as five of these set up, and they'd go off, and you'd better know what you're doing because you don't get too many chances at it. As a matter of fact, that leads me to the next thing, which is that he wouldn't use Polaroid because it hadn't come into play until late in his career. And he thought it was a crutch and it was expensive. So he tried to intuit the best exposures with his light meter, and no Polaroid help. Also, I remember having loaded the film for him into holders. We would shoot three transparencies and two black and white negatives. And then he would be careful enough that generally these would come out really well, and the shoot would be a success. But if you think about the risks, it's a far cry from what goes on today, where you get an instant result digitally, and you can see it on a big computer screen right away, and you know whether you have the picture or not.
Hello, you're listening to Blind Spot Radio. I'm David LaSpina.
And I'm Dave Bush.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back.
Memories, how they fade so fast. Look back, there is no escape. Tie it down, now you see too late. Lovers, they will never wait. I am a camera.
Oh yeah, the great sounds of Yes. I am a camera into the lens. So we're in the midst of a interview with Peter Aaron, the architectural photographer. This is Blind Spot Radio, and we're going to pick up where Pete is talking about the meaning of a stolarized image, which sort of became the way to describe an image that was photographed by Ezra Stoller. So there is a specific look to an Ezra Stoller photograph, and the term has been coined where a building has been stolarized, and I think that has something to do with that black and white look. Can you explain some of the psychological impact of the transformation of a building from three-dimensional space to the way that Ezra Stoller would sort of canonize it?
Well, you have to understand that Ezra was a pioneer, that prior to his contributing to the record of great architecture, buildings were photographed in a very documentary way, maybe just four elevations of the four sides and maybe a general shot from far away, but no expressive photography. It seemed like it was completely neutral. So Ezra would do things to emphasize and to make the building important. And that has to do with a number of things. The one that comes to mind first is lighting. When Ezra would shoot interiors, he knew something that a lot of architects don't know, that if you wait for the light of the sun to come toward the lens through the window, you can get not only a good exposure inside and out, but you can get very dramatic, beautiful lighting. So, for example, the Seagram Building lobby, there's a time of day when the sun pours into the lobby and you can look out at Park Avenue, and there are beautiful lines all over the room, and you can see the racquet club across the street, and no additional lighting is required. And it's that type of dramatic lighting that would be a form of stolarizing that you never would have seen before, because those guys would have just done it with possibly on a cloudy day, so there were no shadows at all, and then you wouldn't see the building across the street. Other things that would make his work iconic or unique compared to what was done before would be the use of wide-angle lenses to create monumentality. The idea that, say, the Dulles Airport is a beautiful Saarinen building in Washington, but it's a horizontal building. So what does Ezra do? He does this beautiful portrait of the end of the building as a vertical shot and makes it as though it's a towering skyscraper. And it's just beautiful. It's interpretive. It's real. There's no Photoshop, but it can make a great cover for a Life magazine article, say. It can the building will be understood by that photo more than the people that go there. It's an important medium, architectural photography, and to have it stolarized, to have your building stolarized, means that the world is going to see it in a more dramatic way.
And so those lenses were only readily available pretty much when he started his career in the 50s, because some of his earliest work, he didn't seem to deal with perspective correction. He sort of just, his very early work, saying 39 when he was right out of college at NYU, he sort of took those cockeyed angles and tilted the camera in all sorts of different ways. By the time that he started that you were working for him, he was working with a 4x5 camera. And earlier, he started with a 4x5 field camera, moved to an 8x10, then to an 8x10 with a 4x5 reduction back. And by the time you were working with him, it was a CNRP.
That's right.
Just to talk about basics, how does a view camera work, and how can it help you photograph architecture in a dramatic way?
Well, a view camera, first of all, the image you see on the screen when your head is under the black cloth is upside down, but it's quite large. It's 4x5 inches. So, and not only that, the camera has a bellows, and so one can move the lens and the film plane around in various ways that are hard to explain, but make the perspective that you can create mimic what can be done in a rendering and in the idealized view that the architect started with when he first designed the project.
It sort of gets around the limits of optics,
Of
straightforward optics.
That's true. So if you're photographing a tall building with a regular camera, you have to tilt the camera up to look at it, and suddenly the building looks like a pyramid. Whereas with one of these cameras, you don't have to tilt the camera up. You can make the lens rise on a pair of rails, and then you can see up, but you're still looking straight at the front door. So it's a trick of perspective. So Ezra was very comfortable looking upside down at a picture under a dark cloth. It takes some getting used to. These days, we do it still with a 35mm style camera, and it can be done either in Photoshop by correcting perspective after the fact, or you can buy a lens that can do that on a 35mm size camera.
Philip Johnson said that the beauty of architecture consists of how you move into a space. Most of Stoller's projects were conceived and presented in a narrative fashion, an approach that you continue to use in your photography. Why is this important in the presentation of a building? Say, moving from the outside to the inside and giving sort of a logical description of a space.
Ezra drummed that into me that architectural photography is a sequence of shots. It's not just unrelated pictures. that it's a kind of a walkthrough. It's like a virtual film, that it's a substitute for being there. And for someone who hasn't been there, it has to explain the building as though you were there. So by keeping in mind when you do your walkthrough to make photographs that get you in the front door, around the first floor, up the stairs, around the second floor, and out to the patio, this is important. Otherwise, you might have pretty pictures, but they won't reveal what the building's like. There's all kinds of considerations that he taught me, that some pictures are of the, we would call the transition spaces, the hallways and the corridors, and other pictures are of the destinations, the person's office or the gym or the living room. He also explained to me that it's good in this virtual walkthrough to try to show more than one room in one picture. One of the most important things he taught me that I think of all the time is to try to have several vistas in one photograph, so that instead of just looking down a hallway, which would be boring, open up a door and look into somebody's office and look down the hallway at the same time. Or instead of seeing just one room, open the door and see into the next room as well. Or look from one room to the other, having the first room be the lead-in. So in other words, instead of seeing a video of the project, you're seeing a virtual video. You're seeing a sequence of pictures that explain where you are.
So did Stoller work at a very frantic pace when he was working? You said he was very calm and collective on the shoot, but he had a high volume of output. We just compiled a list that he worked on 3,500 discrete projects, and that doesn't include the ones that he threw away to, you know, pictures that he did not think were proper architecture or serious assignments. And so it averaged out that he worked about three different jobs per week. And as you know, this can be anywhere between 25 to 130 views of a particular space or particular building. With that sort of consistent output, did it feel like things were frantic when you were working? Did it feel like things were always going? Or does that just seem like it was part of, that's what's necessary to effectively photograph these buildings?
Well, I'll say this. I never thought of it as frantic, the rate at which he took pictures, but I did see a bunch of economizing moves that he would make. The moment the shutter was clicked, the tripod was off the ground and we were on to the next view. But he wouldn't run, or his pulse didn't seem to increase. He was unencumbered by Polaroids or thinking about what he'd already done. That was done and he was certain of it, and he was on to the next thing. He didn't look at a computer screen to see how he'd done. He had nothing to slow him down. And having done the walkthrough, he was quite sure of where he had to go next. There were moments when he got impatient. If, say, he asked me to go up to the sixth floor and take some object off a windowsill, he wouldn't like it if I didn't find the room fast enough, or twilight was approaching and you only have 5 minutes to get a good exposure mix between daylight and the light coming out the windows. You'd better get the Venetian blinds set quickly. So he definitely gave the assistant a lot of responsibility to help him get these pictures at an amazing rate.
Would he ever go back and re-photograph a building if he felt he'd missed something, or was that rare? Was it always just moving forward into the next project?
I'd say it was pretty much always moving forward. He said that often there's talk on the job of coming back another time, but he knew from experience that that almost never happens. Ezra would only go back if there was a real change was going to occur and there was a real budget to go back and really do something different the second time.
Welcome back. You're listening to Blind Spot Radio on WGXC Acra 90.7. And now it's time for a little segment we like to call
Guess That Camera. All right, Dave.
So for this segment, what we do is we have a camera here in the studio, and David is going to release the shutter, release the hounds, and it is up to you, our audience, to either call in or email us at daves@blindspot.com to guess that camera.
Right, and the number here in the studio is 518-828-0290. But now I'm going to shut off the music.
So kill the music.
Kill the music, and we're going to play this
very distinctive camera sound.
Should be easy. Oh, wait, I need to take out the dark slide.
Oh, that's a hint. That's a hint.
Okay, everyone.
Can't believe you gave them a hint.
Well, you know, I try. And we do have our first caller on the line. We go to Curtis in Missouri. Hi, Curtis. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Yeah?
Hey, Curtis.
So what camera do you think you just heard on the sound?
My guess is the Mamiya RZ67.
No. Ooh, pretty close.
Good guess.
Similar lens, mirror action. I did have to take out the dark slide. Do you have one more guess?
You had to take out the dark slide. Is it some model of Hasselblad?
Oh.
Yes.
He got it.
That's it?
He got it.
Our first caller.
Our first caller,
wow.
Our first winner. And,
yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I should have let some other people have a chance to guess it.
Well,
I know.
Okay.
Well, we gave you two chances. All right, so you win a back issue of Blind Spot, which I know is very difficult for you to find. You can't order any of the $150 out-of-print issues. But, yeah, you can pick it up from the WGXC studio in Hudson.
Awesome. Okay.
All right, thanks, Curtis, for listening
Curtis.
In Missouri online. All right, talk to you soon. All right, now, Dave. We're going to pick back up with
Peter Aaron,
and he's talking more about working with Ezra Stoller, but primarily getting into Ezra Stoller's legacy and his status in the art world. He recently had a show at Yossi Milo, and he has a new monograph coming out. He hasn't had one since his early 90s Abrams book, which is out of print, and was sort of a mixture of color work and black and white work and some anecdotes. But since that's difficult for everyone to find, we're very happy that this new monograph we're finally able to put together.
Right.
So here is Peter Aaron. We're talking to him on Blind Spot Radio on WGXC 90.7 Acra, serving Columbia and Greene counties. So why do you think Ezra's legacy might be understated in the art world as opposed to the architecture world? A lot of people, their only conception of how building looks is because of an Ezra Stoller photograph. But he hasn't really been a buzzword or buzz name in the greater world of art for most of his career. Can you tell us a little bit about why that might have happened?
I think Ezra always considered himself a commercial photographer, and he used to say fairly often that the art in his process was the art of the architect, and that he was at the service of the architect, and that his own work was more document or commercial. So he was self-effacing in that aspect. So he didn't do anything to help himself be considered an art photographer, but we all know that there are quite a few of his images that are beautiful and worthy of being in galleries and on the wall, but he thought that was just a happy accident. even, I'll say one more thing. I noticed that in art schools, architectural photography is often a kind of stepchild to art photography because it is so documentary in nature, and anyone making a living at architectural photography is usually just considered a commercial photographer. What else can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a little, surge of, the Edward Bertinskys and Richard Misrach. I mean, they're not particularly doing architectural photography, but they're describing spaces in some of the same methods. Sometimes it's not even as complex as Ezra would do it or an architectural photographer would do it, but they're still sort of making moderate-sized spaces seem grand because of the effects of the large-format camera. Another person comes to mind is Gursky. Mm. You know, he'll stitch together several negatives as he moves around the rear standard of a camera to make something beyond what a regular lens would capture. But mm-hmm. I don't know.
I guess whether it's art or not, I noticed depends on the intent of the photographer. It's funny, you know, when I take a picture of architecture, I work so hard to make sure I get a perfect image. I put all of the furniture in the right place, and I make sure the lighting is just so. And then this important element of art photography disappears, which I would call ambiguity. There's no question in the picture as to why the picture exists or what's happening in the space, whereas an art photographer might leave a pile of garbage or might have some very strange lighting occur that looks like a ghost is in the room or something funny. And then you start to wonder why and what is the intention here. So that's the main difference between a commercial photographer and an art photographer.
But Ezra was always adamant that he was not trying to make something for the sake of art, that he was a tradesman.
That's true.
In service. Anything else you can think of?
Well, yeah. There was a counterpart to Ezra on the West Coast named Julius Shulman. And as far as I remember, Julius Shulman also thought of himself as a commercial photographer. But through a happy twist of fate, some 10 years ago, he was rediscovered and thought to be an art photographer. And this had to do with the aging of the projects and looking back at the whole body of work and seeing a Hollywood and a California that doesn't exist anymore. And so doesn't matter what your intention is, if enough time passes, it can transform itself into art.
All right. That was Peter Aaron, spoke to us from the town of Livingston a couple of weeks ago. We thank him very much for talking to us. Again, you can see Ezra Stoller's work at EzraStoller.com, and Peter is an assignment photographer at Ezra Stoller's agency, Esto. He also has his own personal website, PeterAaron.net.
That brings us to our final segment, which is a bulletin board for the local area.
And a little bit extended area, people involved in Blind Spot. So, Dave, the first person I'm going to talk about, there's a couple lectures happening at Bard coming up in the next couple weeks. We have the very well-known James Casabir, who was included in this year's Whitney Biennial. Is speaking Thursday, March 31st, 6:30 p.m. at the Weiss Cinema at the Bertelsmann Campus Center, which is on the Bard campus. It's also the Student Center. And there's like a movie theater in there. You'll find it.
It's a central location on campus where the following week, Arthur O. Will be speaking on Tuesday, April 5th at 6:30 in the same place.
It's not the same place. He's in the RKC room, which is the new science building.
Right.
Right off the main street.
Right.
Arthur O. also edited an issue of Blind Spot issue 40. And he's been published in other issues, so he's part of the Blind Spot family. That brings us next to Made in Woodstock 5, which is only up for 5 more days until March 27th. That's at the Center for Photography in Woodstock, right there on the main drag. You'll find it. And Made in Woodstock is the 5th installment of the Center for Photography Woodstock series, featuring work created by recent participants of the Woodstock Air, which is an artist in residency program for artists of color working within the photographic arts.
And speaking of CPW, which always has lots of shows, the Photography Now 2011 exhibition will be going up and opening on April 9th and will run through May 30th. It includes our good friend Chad Pleitch, among other many talented artists.
And then locally, right in Hudson on Warren Street, there's Carrie Haddad Photography, which is featuring a group show. That opened up March 3rd, but it continues through April 10th, featuring photographers Ida Weigand and her series The Hunt, also with Peter Leipke and David Seiler.
I think it's Leipke.
Leipke, excuse me.
I don't know.
And then traveling back down to New Paltz, Dave is going to tell
us. March 30th through July 17th at the Samuel Dorsky Museum of Art at SUNY New Paltz, Tim Davis will be sharing that space, that wonderful space down there, with Ken Landauer and Julianne Schwartz,
who will be presenting their work Thick and Thin.
And Tim's work is called The Upstate New York Olympics, which is videos that Tim made, which are very funny.
Very funny. They're performance pieces and take a spin on the Olympics. His website, davistim.com, features YouTube links if you're interested in previewing that. But I think you should really see the projections.
Yeah.
In HD. Friday, April 8th is the reception for the artists, and I think the public is welcome. I hope we're okay with saying that.
Yeah.
The next thing I want to talk about is the Columbia County Photo Club, which has their monthly meetings every other Tuesday at the Hudson Library. They're meeting tonight, March 22nd, 6 p.m. at the Hudson Library, I think upstairs. My inbox tells me that they have a very active Facebook page, which you can find by searching for the Columbia County Photo Club. So get in contact with them or just go to a meeting and they'll put you on their mailing list.
Moving a little bit out of town to Philadelphia is the Philadelphia Photo Arts Fair. They'll be hosting their second annual book fair Saturday, April 2nd, from 12 to 6.
And participants include JNL Books, which is run by Jason Fulford, another Blind Spot Magazine contributor and guest editor, Brian Graff, someone that my friend that I went to school with, but he makes artist books. Some other highlights are Ofer Wolberger, Sarah Stolfer, and her partner in running the PPAC, Christopher Gianzino. Also there will be Lay Flat, which is a publication that will be co-edited by Dana Ficanti for its next issue. And that information is at philaphotoarts.org.
All of these links will be posted on our new radio page as of April 1st, possibly earlier, blindspot.com/radio, or you can email us at daves@blindspot.com.
All right. And we also want to talk about this great station that we're on, WGXC,
right,
which will be is in need of a fund drive, which is going to be coming up April 4th through 11th. You can go to wgxc.org/donate. Dave also wanted to quickly say something about Japan.
Well, yeah, I just, you know, considering what's happening in Japan, I want to encourage everyone to contribute to whatever charity they see fit to contribute to help the people of Japan. It's time for us to come together and help them out.
And next month, Blind Spot is excited. The next issue is edited by Zoe Leonard and Maura Davey, who were artists in residence at Bard last month. They're next issue is going to be themed around journals and writing and photography. It's going to be very complex and nice. And our next show will probably include an interview with Stephen Shore, who extensively used journals.
He might not know that yet.
Yeah. News to him.
Right.
But we're planning to have an interview with him and talking about his journal taking on his trips out west in the 70s. He collected postcards, receipts, things of that ilk. And also have some discussion with Zoe Leonard-Moore-Davey. We'll be trying to put that together. You can find our podcast link on blindspot.com/radio, and we're going to take you out with the Speedies.